Rhys said slowly. What do you want from me? Answering a question with a question, the president asked, What do you think our adversaries have been doing while we've been fighting the war on terror? Rhys paused. He was in a job interview. They've been learning, sir. They've been adapting. China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. They watched us destroy Saddam's military in 1993 when they went head-to-head with us in a conventional conflict. We did it again in 2003. Then they watched those same technological advances rendered ineffective by various factions and splinter groups, wielding AKs, RPGs, and IEDs, by insurgents whose goal was to run out the clock.
That's right. We need to regroup, Rhys. Our main state adversaries know how to fight us and win. We've shown them how over the past two decades.
Sir, with all due respect, you can have these conversations with any number of policy wonks in the swamp. What am I doing here?
True,
though only a select few really understand the nature of the conflict in which we are engaged, and more importantly, understand what you just so clearly articulated. The president stopped and lowered his voice. The resolution was never fully utilized in accordance with the intent of Congress and the American people.
Sir?
Read Section 1 again.
Rhys tilted the frame and read, This joint resolution may be cited as the authorization for use of military force.
Section 2. Authorization for use of United States Armed Forces. The President is authorized to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001, or harbored such organizations or persons, in order to prevent any future acts of international terrorism against the United States by such nations, organizations, or persons.
Read that last part again, Commander.
Organizations or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001.
We've gotten so far away from that original intent.
Someone's face had to be plastered on TV and on those targets at gun stores across the nation. The American public needed to give evil a name, so we handed them 19 dead hijackers and Osama bin Laden. Sure, there was a supporting cast of characters, but they were all overseas, living in caves, to be rooted out and destroyed by our new heroes in special operations. No one wanted to know the truth.
What truth, Mr. President?
The truth is that the support network from 9/11 still exists. The president reached across the small coffee table that separated them and set down three files.
Have you heard of File 17, Mr. Rhys?
Isn't that the file President Obama declassified a few years ago that pointed to a Saudi connection to 9/11?
Yes.
Though it was more to placate some of the families of victims. It was all circumstantial and relatively benign, barely registered in the public consciousness.
What's this one? Rhys asked, picking up the next file. That's the 28 redacted pages from the 9/11 Commission report. Also mostly circumstantial and likely would only have hurt relations with the Saudis in the wake of 9/11, an ally we needed in the region.
And this? Rhys asked, holding up the third file.
That, Commander, is a target package.
Open it. Rhys flipped the page and began to read.
Take your time.
When Rhys picked his head up, the most powerful man on Earth was staring at him with an intensity born in battle.
The terrorists in that package are still out there. They still live among us.
They didn't fly the planes or slash throats of pilots and flight attendants, but without them, 9/11 would not have happened.
Jen would still be alive, as would almost 3,000 others, not to mention those killed on both sides in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Rhys, there was a concerted effort to convince the American people that there were only 19 hijackers, plus Zacharias Moussaoui, the 20th hijacker.
There were more. A network of facilitators. I always knew it.
I want you to finish
what we started in 2001. The country has lost its appetite. If we bring them to trial now, it's years of pain and political infighting. That joint resolution you just read gives the President of the United States the ability to bring all those who enabled the 9/11 attacks to justice.
I think I'll take that drink now, Mr. President. The President stood and returned with two tumblers.
On the rocks, no water.
Was that in my file, too?
No, just a guess.
It was a good one.
What do you know about Operation Wrath of God, Commander?
It was the Israeli response to the Munich massacre. 11 Israeli athletes were killed by Black September at the 1972 Olympics. Wrath of God was authorized by Prime Minister Golda Meir. Mossad hit teams deployed worldwide to kill those responsible and to send a message.
That's right.
What are your thoughts on targeted assassinations?
Reese took a sip and looked around the room.
Don't worry. Like I said, this is the one place I trust not to be recording my every word. It's one of the reasons we are meeting here and not in the White House. Plus, visitor logs are almost impossible to doctor these days.
Isn't there an executive order that prohibits assassination?
There is. But legally, that definition of assassination refers to a head of state. Individuals can be targeted with what's referred to as a notification, just like with bin Laden. Reagan issued a directive in 83 for the mastermind of the Beirut embassy and Marine barracks bombings. There are new notifications in the back of the file, signed by me.
Reese set down his drink.
Sir, are you asking me or ordering me to kill everyone on this list?
Think of this as an exploratory conversation. The 7 people on that list were under surveillance for 10 years as persons of interest. We never put them on the no-fly list. We wanted to watch and observe to find out who else they were in contact with, to continue to gather intelligence, to use them to disrupt any possible sleeper cells preparing for another wave of attacks. They never led us anywhere. Surveillance was called off in 2011 after the bin Laden raid.
Maybe we were watching the wrong people,
Reese countered.
Spend some time with that file. We have the right people.
Reese took a long sip of his drink.
Reese, do you know that the President of the United States does not even undergo a background investigation?
Reese shook his head.
Do you know why that is?
My guess is that none of you would pass it.
An excellent deduction, and true.
A president does not even have a security clearance, yet has unfettered access to our nation's most closely guarded secrets. A president can read anything. He can classify or declassify anything. That's the power of this seat, Mr. Reese. That's why I'm here, to find out who made 9/11 possible and bring them to justice.
Why me?
I think you know the answer.
Reese swirled the dark, smooth liquid in his glass.
Because I've done it before.
If things go south, you can point to me as a renegade CIA asset who went off the reservation. I have a history. This meeting is off the books. It becomes just another crazy conspiracy theory like the Kennedy assassination. Anything tying me to you is lost in classified files, just like Dallas. Those notifications in the file disappear. If I'm successful and take them out quietly, it still gets classified in the mountains of files that only a president can access. Maybe I have an accident to further muddy the waters in case anyone came looking.
Reese's head was spinning.
Not long ago, when he thought he was dying, he'd killed on home soil. Some saw his actions as murder, others as justice. Believing he was already dead gave him a freedom to seal the fate of all those who had taken everything from him. That freedom to become an insurgent on home soil allowed him an effectiveness and efficiency through the acceptance of a fast approaching death. He'd bottled that part of his life up and packed it away in the deepest recesses of his mind.
His wife, daughter, and unborn son slaughtered in their home. His troop ambushed in the mountains of the Hindu Kush. It had been orchestrated by a cabal of senior military officers, political leaders, and private sector financiers, all of whom Reese put in the ground.
Sir, I'll need to think about it.
I understand. The president stood and started toward the door. Reese took the hint and followed suit.
We've prepared a cabin for you. Think it through. Get a workout in. The gym isn't so bad. Shoot some clays. In the morning we can have breakfast.
Ahilo will be here at 10 to take you back to the farm. If you decide against it, it will be like you were never here, and I expect you to never breathe a word of our conversation to anyone. They stopped at the entrance, and the president opened the door for his guest.
And remember, don't trust anyone.
Even you, Mr. President?
Trust no one, Reese.
Reese nodded.
Oh, Commander, before you go, there is one other thing.
Chapter 8. The gym was empty. Reese pushed himself hard in round after round of kettlebell swings, Turkish get-ups, and sprints. He lost track of the rounds and continued to push, spurred on by visions of the living and the dead. Katie, Lauren, Lucy, Freddie. Faces of those he'd tortured and killed in a quest for vengeance. His mind came to focus on one person in particular, a sniper whose face he'd only seen in a surveillance photograph, a man whose finger had pressed a trigger and killed Freddie Strain, leaving his wife without a husband and his children without a father. A man Reese was going to kill. Jogging back to his cabin, he'd thought of Freddie's special needs child, Sam, now dependent on just one parent for his very survival. Freddie was dead because of Reese. The money Reese had used to fund Samuel Strain's special needs trust would ensure the child had a lifetime of medical care. But what he really needed was a father. What Joni Strain needed was her husband. Reese had promised her that he would kill everyone responsible. To do that, he needed the resources of the CIA. As Reese lay on his bunk, watching the fans slowly turning in the shadows of the early evening light, he thought about what the president had asked of him as he left Aspen Cabin.
Oh, Commander, before you go, there is one other thing. On September 10th, Mohammed Atta and Abdulaziz al-Omri traveled from Boston to South Portland, Maine. It's been speculated that they did so because of a more lax security posture at Portland International Jetport, but that doesn't make sense. They still had to pass through security at Logan in Boston. Atta was even selected for additional screening. They made it through security just 15 minutes before takeoff. Atta nearly missed the appointment for his own death. I want to know who they met in Maine, Mr. Reese. The FBI, CIA, no one has been able to figure it out. Find out. Find out and let me know.
With each turn of the fan, Reese saw pictures of the 9/11 hijackers imprinted in his brain, finally settling on the passport photo of Mohammed Atta. It had been broadcast across the world in the months after the attack. Dark-collared button-up over a white T-shirt, lips pressed together, the dead dark eyes. Forever frozen in time, at 33 years old, he had been an instrument that helped change the course of history.
Who did you meet in Maine? Reese thought.
Whoever it was, Reese knew they'd be added to the president's list. If it was an agent of a foreign intelligence service, Reese could only imagine what the leader of the free world would do. A man in that seat wielded a power greater than anyone in recorded history. With ever-changing launch codes and the turn of a key, he could remove entire regions of the globe from existence. The authorization for use of military force and Presidential Directive 9 gave him that authority. The president had entrusted Reese with a secret. The popular president was not in office as a servant to his nation. He had fought overseas and returned home to amass a fortune and run for the highest office in the land, not out of duty, but out of a need for vengeance, to avenge one particular victim of 9/11. Rees understood revenge, which is precisely why the president had chosen him for this mission. As Rees closed his eyes and fought off the nightmares, he remembered the pastor at Freddie's funeral echoing the words from Isaiah chapter 6, verse 8, that he'd heard recited over the graves of so many of his SEAL brothers.
"Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, Whom shall I send, and who will go for us? And I said, Here am I. Send me."
Rees was going back to war. Chapter 9. Washington, D.C. As Iran's chief intelligence operative in the United States, Hafez Qassem had been conducting what amounted to a year-long surveillance detection route. He'd been followed by agents from what he correctly assumed to be the Foreign Counterintelligence Squad of the FBI's Washington field office for the better part of a year when he first took the post, though he pretended not to notice. He did not meet with sources, nor did he do anything the least bit suspicious. He went to dinners, as would be expected of a diplomat of his station, attended soccer games, drank in moderation, and every now and again would stuff dollar bills into G-strings at Good Guys Gentlemen's Club on Wisconsin Avenue in the shadow of the United States Naval Observatory. He was setting the conditions. The Iranian embassy in the United States had been boarded up since 1979 following the Iranian Revolution, the rise of Ayatollah Khomeini, and the ensuing hostage crisis that would usher in the Reagan era. Diplomatic matters were handled through the Interests section of the Islamic Republic of Iran in the United States, which was conveniently housed in the Embassy of Pakistan on 1250 23rd Street Northwest in Washington, D.C. As part of a small Iranian contingency, Qassem enjoyed diplomatic immunity and could travel freely to and from Iran on one of the planes designated for the Iranian ambassador to the United Nations in New York. As Iran's top spy in the United States, his job was not to spot, develop, and recruit spies. He had a network at the tactical level responsible for identifying potential assets. His job was to oversee that intelligence, to analyze it for exploitation, identify patterns, and detect possible double agents. It was well known that the NSA collected and read all electronic communications in and out of Iran, so Qassem's reports were sent directly to the Supreme Council of National Security via diplomatic pouch. Because he was not actively involved in recruitment, there was little the United States could do about him. As with every other embassy, to include those of staunch U.S. allies, it was expected for there to be an intelligence section to the diplomatic mission, just as the United States operated out of all of their embassies and consulates abroad. To the Americans, he was a boring bureaucrat, enjoying a drink or two beyond the watchful eye of the regime. Americans could understand that. It was the ones who never drank, prayed five times a day, and avoided scantily clad women who made them nervous. After the first 6 months, his around-the-clock initial surveillance was reduced to what amounted to a checkup, to ensure nothing had changed and that Qassem was still passing his time with nice dinners and soccer games. When the FBI did monitor his activities, they were easy to spot. Qassem had been a player in the game long enough to know when something was out of place. He hadn't met physically with an asset on American soil in almost 20 years, back when meeting in a pizza restaurant in Maine had made his career and altered the destiny of a nation. Following the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq, the up-and-coming spymaster had successfully turned it into a client state of Iran. CIA sources, as part of their deep penetration programs, eagerly switched sides after the American abandonment, believing their past CIA associations would come to light. They were looking for a new guardian. The intelligence windfall on CIA tactics, techniques, and procedures was a treasure trove for the regime. Qasem was rewarded with a promotion. More recently, he had overseen the recruitment of U.S. Air Force Sergeant Monica Elfried Witt. She defected to Iran in 2013 and still lived there today. Qasem had met with her numerous times over the years and spent untold hours reading her debriefings. The Americans had not realized what was happening until she was safely on Iranian soil. They should have killed her at the first hint of betrayal, before she was beyond their grasp. That's what Qasem would have done. Raped, tortured, and killed.